Welcome to MR Squared, a Massachusetts Review recording of interviews, readings, and all things literary. I'm Jim Hicks, MR's editor. Today, we bring you a recast broadcast from the original MR Squared, David Lenson's radio show. Lynn Margulis, professor extraordinaire of geosciences at the University of Massachusetts, passed away on November 22nd. A scientist who somehow found time for life, not just science, Lynn was also a regular on MR Squared. In this show from 2007, she chats with David and Roger Figo about her Luminous Fish, a book of short stories and memoir. Illuminating indeed.
Our guest this week is this your third time? I think you're back.
Huh? I don't know. Not enough.
Not enough.
I love it.
Our guest is Lynn Margulis, who has a brand new book called Luminous Fish, Tales of Science and Love. Lynn is a professor of geosciences here at the University of Massachusetts and the author of many books, too many books to mention, let's just say. Have you lost count yet?
It depends on how you count them, whether they're chapters or a single edited or whether I did it all myself or whether whatever. But none of them are like this one.
No, none of them are like this one. This is true. No, she's admit some of the titles are What is Sex? Always a good question. Slanted Truths, Essays on Gaia, Symbiosis, and Evolution. Five Kingdoms, An Illustrated Guide to the Phyla of Life on Earth, which I could really use to read because Symbiotic Planet, I still think there's only like two kingdoms. And many, 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 many others. But the new one, as Lynn says, is very different. Let's see if we can characterize this incredibly beautiful book with a very luminous, luminous fish on the front. This book has in it four short stories with a prologue and an epilogue, and then a wonderful memoir of a meeting with J. Robert Oppenheimer back in Princeton back in the 60s. And so I would say, you know, just being, you know, the cheap literary critic, that that this book focuses on that point where life and science, shall we say, converge or collide, sometimes converge, sometimes collide, where human impulses come either into conflict or into concert with the human desire for knowledge. And it's a very exciting point, and that's the pivot of this book in so many ways. And with it comes every form of imaginable solution to that conundrum, possibly grounded in the with the memoir about J. Robert Oppenheimer, because Oppenheimer had to face the decision kind of magnified to world historical proportions that, in some sense, every scientist has to make. What do you do with the knowledge? Well, welcome back after that windy prologue.
No, that's a wonderful prologue. I think Chick Kallenbach, who wrote Ecotopia, did you ever read that
thing? No, I haven't.
Oh, it's about the secession of Northern California only, Oregon and Washington, from the United States for about 40 years. And the hippies go on in that Northwest, and the rest of the country goes in the same direction it's going now. And then there's contact made after 30 years. It's fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, he was the head of the film quarterly at Berkeley in the University of California. And it's called Ernest on the back, because his real name's Ernest. But I just wanted to tell you what he said, because I think I was amazed that he said it. Difficult artists, this is the back of the book, difficult artists and writers are plentiful in fiction, but Margulis has a unique and vivid gift for portraying work-driven scientists and their mystified, vexed, or frustrated mates and friends. And I think he's got it right on, because that's the conflict.
Mm-hmm. You know, through all of the books of yours that I've read, you seem to always have the mission of speaking out of the sciences towards the world at large. And this is something that you do very, very well, maybe especially well in this book. Because, you know, for most of us, science is a mystery. And I think I described this morning on the phone with you that I thought that Hang on, we've got DJ Bongo Head beating his bongos in the next room there.
Yeah.
But that, in a way, that was your mission was a sort of single person of war on the two cultures phenomenon that was described by C.P. Snow about a century ago.
Well, I think the real problem is that scientists are not talking to each other either. Mm. That, they tend to understand their little teeny specialty, and the more you know, they tend to know more and more about less and less until they know everything about nothing, whereas philosophers tend to know less and less about more and more until they know nothing about everything. And this tendency is marked in all people. But it's remarkable how little the knowledge diffuses. And I'm really interested in a large number of topics in science because, to me, science is the only way of knowing. Well, maybe it's not. It's the best way of knowing. There's other ways of knowing, of course. But science is the way that you can know something better. You can't know it. There's no truth, but you know it better and better. Because it's something that people can measure and observe the same thing and think about it and put it in context and come to the same conclusions regardless of the slant of their eyes or the color of their skin. It's something that we all can do, and in principle, everybody can do science. And in practice, a lot of people do. A lot of people come from very different backgrounds, and they do participate in science. So to me, science is the way of knowing. And it's so discouraging to me when the entire culture teaches and believes stuff for which there's very good evidence against. I mean, it's not that it's not right. It's that it's wrong in every way, and they have no way of evaluating. As a culture, we have no way of evaluating whether it's a good piece of information or if it's a ridiculous piece of information, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, and of course, in the acceleration of information in the so-called information age here, where there are so many ways to convey little digital particles of knowledge from one point to another, and the ability to differentiate between what's important or even interesting is really kind of vanished.
Well, I would never say interesting. I take interesting out of all my students' work. When they say this is interesting, I say to who? To your mother? I mean, the things I find interesting, nobody does. But important in the sense, important in the sense that these people in these scientific activities are important because they make decisions and make measurements that have huge amount of influence that they can't even possibly predict that they're going to have influence. And what I'm trying to show is that the personal lives that seem like a personal decision. Some guy's mistress is pregnant. He's got to get rid of it. He's developing pills. Can turn out to be amplified and have huge effects on so many people. And, of course, the dropping of the atom bomb. We read here that Tibbetts, the guy who flew the plane, his life was preserved in exchange for 100,000 Japanese. Mm. And, I mean, that's what's happening here. And it's this amplification effect of where the personal just inevitably becomes socially broad and with great implication for social consequences.
What Lynn's referring to there is Tibbetts, of course, was the pilot of the Enola Gay that dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And the question is whether or not the United States should have given warning to Japan in advance. And it was decided not to because that might jeopardize the life of the pilot. That is, the plane bearing the first atomic weapon might have been shot down had they known it was coming.
Thank you very much for explaining that.
No, that's okay. There's not everybody out there has read your book yet, but by the end of the week, you know, it'll be a different story.
Maybe Lynn, also, science has risen to the most important place in our culture in terms of the work that it does, and maybe the least corruptible at this point. And it hasn't been a subject for literature. There hasn't been someone looking at the inner lives of scientists. It's been, you know, other characters in the history of literature or in
journalists,
society that have been interesting.
Do it, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let me just tell you, this is what I thought too, and I found out, I want to read just very little. Ramon y Cajal, do you know who he was, what he did? You all know what he did because you've heard of a neuron, that is the nerve cell, the Well, he's the one who discovered the nerve cell, and people at the time thought there was a net, the synapses, the connections between the nerve cells. And he's the only Spaniard in the history of the Nobel Prize to have gotten a Nobel Prize in science. Lots of them in literature, but not in science. And I just want to read from this because he wrote 12 vacation stories. Six of them are lost forever. Six of them we can't recover. Six of them have been published. He got the Nobel Prize in 1906. When was he translated into English? The vacation stories? 2001. Anyway, typical. But let me tell you what he says here. Moser, her lover, is speaking to Emma, the wife of Max von Forschung, Professor Ordinarius, who's a very important professor, much more important than professors at UMass, for example. Because a professor means you're the head of the whole department there.
Right.
And Moser is saying to Emma, permit me to tell you, Moser, her lover, to Emma, at Würzburg, the University of Würzburg, that men bottled up in scientific investigation never love anything but science. Given the choice between a beauty and a microbe, they opt for the latter. For them, a woman represents, at the most, a fleeting, disturbing episode that occurred in their youth. And I think I was just thrilled to see that in 2002 when this book was. But as far as I know, he is the only person who just did really important science, who bothered to write. I mean, I guess Gerasi has. The guys who wrote the Oxygen play, Gerasi and the chemist, Raoul Hoffman. But yeah, I don't think...
Who's also an MR contributor, by the way.
Who?
Hoffman.
Yes, yeah. Well,
he's one of our 9 Nobel Prize winners, the only one not a Nobel Prize winner in literature.
Of course, but I would still contest, well, I mean, I love Raoul Hoffman, and I think he's a marvelous guy, but I certainly don't think that they've risen to literature with that play. I mean, mm-hmm. The play is peevish. It's about credit. It's not about the scientific issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. I mean, at one time, before the great divide of the two cultures, any literate person could read the most recent scientific book and make sense out of it. And we have instances of people like Goethe, for example, choosing to write a long tractatus on optics.
And Goethe was both a science and a literary person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But and that's difficult. I mean, you're pretty close to both of those. I mean, you had a translated poem of Garcia Lorca.
That's the pride of our life, yes.
So.
She dropped her dress.
Yes. Well, it was not the only dress that's been dropped in the pages of the Massachusetts Review. And there's pretty much one every issue if
but
you read carefully.
But the big issue is that scientists can't write if they were... When they're able to write, I mean, there are wonderful scientists, students, who, when they're able to write, they're siphoned off because they're needed so badly. So they tend to be siphoned off to scientific journalism or teaching at some level. But most scientists can calculate, but they can't write because they don't ever say what they mean. And back to Roger's comment, Butler said, beware the scientist, for he is the high priest of the New Age. There's a big problem there because... They're imbued with this knowledge and the priesthood type of knowledge, and scientists know more and more about less and less, and they extrapolate in their area of expertise. They do very well, but the expertise in order to be science has to be arcane, idiosyncratic, just very limited. Mm-hmm. And the problem is the tendency to go from very good knowledge of a very limited field to making pronouncements about in areas where they don't belong. And I think it's a tragedy. It's horrible.
I don't see why that would necessarily have to be. And I was at least under the sort of maybe naively optimistic impression that science... most of all would benefit from the sort of information age and the internet, where information that just by the nature of its conduit flowed more freely and people all over the world had access to the same information, therefore, you know, stirring the pot up to a higher temperature, yielding more results.
They would still be
subject to scientific, you know, review. It wouldn't seem to compromise them. Or it wouldn't seem, I don't see why, you know, what why it becomes, you know, less and less important, as opposed to seeing a bigger picture because of that.
Because the pressures on scientists, and that the information point you make is correct. Right now, the information is flowing better and better amongst lots of people, practically independently of the media, for example. But the problem, basically, is that in order to do anything in science, do something, not write about it or talk about it or read about it, but do something, it takes intense dedication to highly specific and idiosyncratic and arcane activity. And this does not lead toward literary knowledge or toward literary expansion. And you are punished. You are punished if you talk out of your field or you write things out of your field. I mean, that's why this thing has been incubating. This book, Luminous Fish, has been incubating since 1956. It was rejected, I can't tell you how many times. And but a lot of it was rejected by Dan Born, the same person who was accepting. Why? Because it was, what are we going to do with this? It's got so many scientific words in it. Who's going to read this? I mean...
Well, actually, I think as just reading it as fiction, some of these long passages about science may escape me in their particulars, but in the generality of them, you get the idea. You want to have some of the discourse that goes on. And this discourse is sometimes scientific, but also philosophical. In the first of the stories, the people are arguing about the fundamentals of empiricism and empiricism as a way of knowing. And, you know, it's nice to hear that. Fiction, characters in fiction don't really talk about that stuff very much. And
yeah, but science students do, and philosophy students do.
Oh, yeah.
Liberal arts students do, and then they get it beat it out of them as they get a job and so on.
Sure. I mean, when we all stayed up until 4 o'clock in the morning arguing points that we really don't even want to talk about for 5 minutes today. You know? Yeah, like I made up my mind about empiricism.
Right. Yeah, but it's
like,
it is the human side.
Mm-hmm. It's like exercise. It's, you know, it creates more neurons, all that. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily, you know, the substance of it, mm-hmm. I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, it may be that someone in the sciences reading this book would certainly read it differently than someone gazing in from outside. However, there are certain things about your scientist characters in here that I've noticed in scientists that I know, and there's actually scientists in my family. On my wife's side, we have my brother-in-law who works in Morrill, where you are, and then my sister-in-law who has the grandiose title of head of science at Harvard Medical School. And I would say that, at least in her case, as she was formerly an editor at Cell Magazine, this enormous amount of travel that goes on is a kind of aspect of the scientific life that wouldn't have occurred to me had I not seen Judy rack up the frequent flyer miles all these years. I mean, these conferences, which, of course, make wonderful settings for things to happen in a short story, is a real big part of the life of science.
That's because you read the materials and methods section in scientific papers, and you can't really follow them as recipes until you talk to the people who do it on an everyday basis. Mm. It's just a one personal conversation, and even better, being taken around a laboratory or a field experience is just worth, you can't, it's just not comparable.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably part of the reason we do videos. We do videos of live material all the time because you've got 24 frames a second. Mm. And nothing speaks louder than a feeling for the organism, that is, knowing the organism.
Do you think that the sort of peregrine aspect of science will die down as the internet becomes easier to use, as we can exchange enormous video files and that kind of data?
No, I just think you'll have more and more information that will be passing, because there's nothing like personal contact, which is exactly the point of this story. There's a vast difference between personal experience. In my personal experience, the greatest scientists are the most humble. They're aware that every day they know relatively less because the world knows more. So any part that a single person can learn is less and less. And they are look with circumspection and are critical of their elders and their betters, because that's the nature of science. So, and science is very different than other activities. Therefore, the personal communication is crucial.
Mm-hmm. Seems like Isaac Newton, unless he's a real anomaly.
Yeah, he is.
Okay.
In every way. He lived with his mother. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, he represents someone that didn't need that much contact. I mean, you know, he sequestered himself and wrote the, you know, major thing that he wrote on calculus or something without, you know, without context, generated from his own, you know, self-thought.
Well, there's a lot of people like that. J. Willard Gibbs was like that, and Einstein, to a large extent, was like that. Mm. I think it's the nature of the kind of science you do, too, whether or not, how much people contact. But the people contact is very specific. I mean, they can send the manager or the president, and who they send makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah, you say one story opens with a flat-out statement that big science is a deal with the devil.
Yes.
And I think the obvious elephant that we haven't yet acknowledged in the room is money. When you were saying a moment ago that in order to pursue things, in order to really do something, you know, you've got to get out there and you have to really look and you have to collect data and so on. But with every year that goes by, this becomes more expensive.
Well, not really. The kind of thing they call science becomes more expensive. Big pharma, I mean, for example, I think medical science is almost as big a contradiction in terms as military intelligence, that in fact there is no science in medicine at all. It's shocking that once you get to people, the standards of everything change. Of course, it's more expensive, but much more than that, your work is not subject to the kind of criticism. If you're doing with astronomy or something very obscure, then the people who can criticize do criticize. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things going on.
Even when you do outrageous things in that profession, can get away with it. I'm saying even when medical people...
I think you have to understand that the Hippocratic Oath says, I will... honor the man who taught me these arts and teach it to his sons. The loyalty is to people. And when you mention money in big science, you have to have that loyalty to other people and impress them and do all this publicity stuff. For that reason, after 34 years of work with NASA, we are not funded at all. And I'm right now at the absolute height of my scientific progress on symbiosis and evolution. I mean, we have news and it's fabulous, but the people working on it on a day-to-day basis are not paid for this work at all. Right. Because so I say that in a way, big science is a deal, because once you have big science, you have to have papers that are consensual, and then you're consensus building, and that can't be. The science that Lovelock does, for example, is very inexpensive.
Well, what about the science that Lovelee does? Here at the university, I'm just interested in whether that, because that seemed to attract a lot of money, and yet it seemed to be, you know, really pure science.
Well, if devising techniques for nuclear waste is pure science, I mean, there's a reason, or anyway.
Now, is applied science also an oxymoron?
Less.
Less. Because there's a wonderful moment in here where you have a number of people who are interested in gases and the way gases behave in the atmosphere. And in fact, one of your principal protagonists is obsessed with gases and the way gases behave for his whole life. And then suddenly comes the environmental crisis of the 70s and the realization that greenhouse gases may be holding warmth up against the Earth with who knows what consequences. So suddenly their work, which had been apparently pure science, becomes... A political football.
And all he wants to do is escape from it. And you really understand where he's coming from. Because the minute he has to deal with a lot of people, he's one that's more like Isaac Newton. And he can't even deal with his best lover. So,
yeah. Well, I think
that's very realistic. And in his particular case, well, I say in here, there's... You know, Philip Morrison and Oppenheimer and Sagan, they're people that are real, and I say who they are because I want to make it very clear that that's mostly in the last one. But these other people are literal recombinants that are plausible recombinants of people I do know.
Yeah, they are very plausible. But I don't think it's a Roma, a clay, where your friends are going to go around circling names and writing other names in the margins. I may try, though.
Well, they'll be wrong on many of them, especially my New Jersey guy, who I'm very fond of, and I literally don't know him. I mean, I've patched him together. He's the one that calculates for a living. He calculates probabilities for a living. He's very good at it. He's the one that has sort of gotten rid of, by bizarre ways, of his family obligations, and he is capable of coming, not only speaking French, but coming to meetings on time. And he's a very rational person. He's genuinely a rational person, and it's very easy to get along with. And so he gets promoted and promoted and promoted, and he gets into situations he doesn't want to be in. But I really like him. The idea that you calculate very low probability, high impact events is his modus operandi.
Sure, but then he has a very low probability, high impact event himself.
You got to the end
of it,
huh?
Yes, when he runs into all of them.
Don't tell.
No, all right.
Thing.
I won't give away the ending.
Yeah, right.
I won't give away.
But I can see you did a lot of reading today.
No, I made it. Yeah.
Hey, I have to tell you, from three or four years, David, he's no slouch, man. He finishes the book.
Hey,
last week I made it through Martin Amis's novel with 7 minutes to spare. So let me just say that we're talking to Lynn Margulis, the author most recently of Luminous Fish, Tales of Science and Love. I did want to talk a little bit about your meeting with Oppenheimer. I mean, it was pretty much audacity on your part. You just kind of found his house in Princeton and just kind of noticed that family were on the way to the car and just kind of went up and said hi.
Yeah, I did. It was worse than that because, as you noticed, I was not allowed to go. I mean, I can tell you, read it a little bit. I wasn't allowed to go to Sagan's house because what was this girl going home with? I was 16, you know. And I had spent the semester writing this paper called Not Whether or Not, But How. Or
right, yeah.
Not
mm-hmm.
How, but Whether or Not. And that was Whether or Not to drop the bomb.
Right.
And a lot of papers at that moment had been released. The case had been released. It was no longer classified. So there was all sorts of people trying to make news out of Oppenheimer. And Anyway, I had read all about this. I had read Brighter Than a Thousand Suns, I think, by then, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't go to Rahway. I didn't know anybody in New Jersey, and I was reading Harold Bloom's Times Arrow, and it was, that I had huge insight because his relationship with his wife, Kitty, was so bad, and everybody had known what a romantic situation that had been when they had first met. And it had degenerated so badly. And when he was so nice to me and she told me, well, you can stay, but only for 20 minutes or something like that, and he looked miserable, I felt, oh, my God, this has been going on for years. So there was this big discrepancy between public and private life, which I found very interesting. So I ran and wrote it down, and I wrote it down exactly verbatim of what happened, and it took me like 30, 40 years to get back to it, and also put the context around it and so on.
Yeah, no, it's very beautiful, and it's very, it really evokes those leafy back streets in Princeton. Where,
you're from Princeton.
Yeah, well, I spent a lot of time in Princeton, and and of course he was at the Institute, I guess, which is a real...
It was across the lawn from there.
Yeah, it's a beautiful part of town. We used to drop LSD and go walking in the Institute woods all the time. It was the best place. There was a little bridge
in
there.
I called the Nassau Tavern, which it was at the time, Yankee Shibui, and I learned from my Japanese girl that Shibui is sort of studied elegance. It's kind of, it's not crass elegance at all. It's much more quiet. It's kind of like bonsai. And I found that place Yankee elegance of a kind I never had in my own life coming from the Midwest.
Yeah. But it was very sweet. But also, I was kind of touched by the one mention of the 10-year-old daughter, Tony, in the back seat because I knew her. I went to graduate school with her.
She committed suicide.
She did. But,
and I didn't find that out until 25 years.
Yeah.
Do you have any insight into that?
No, I don't. In graduate school, she was a Russian. She was a graduate student in Russian.
You were a graduate student with her?
Yes.
Where was that?
At Princeton. And she was in the Russian department. I was in Complet, so we were kind of adjacent. And actually, I didn't know her really well, but I did know her fairly well, you know.
And you have no insight into this?
No insight at all. It didn't happen. She didn't commit suicide till some years later. But it was funny because, of course, there are two different impulses operating there. One is the, you know, studying Russian as an as a way of reaching out to what was then the enemy, but also perhaps as a kind of reaction to the persecution that Oppenheimer underwent during the McCarthy era, which was the last time the United States veered towards fascism before this one.
Well, you may have noticed that in this story, which is in Philip Morrison was 22 when he armed the fat man at Tinian, and he was a very young physics student, and he just died 2 years ago. People came out of the walls when he died. I mean, people came from Africa. He would sit on the floor and play with the grown-ups even. He was just a fantastic intellectual person who was very non-big science. He's the most non-big science. But you may have noticed that in that it's a conversation between Phil Morrison, who's spinning this globe at his house, and David Hawkins. Now, David Hawkins was a marvelous person who really changed my life. He was a professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado, and by the time I knew him, these events, of course, had happened way before. But they had assigned to him, when he was at Los Alamos as a young man, they had assigned to him the writing of the document. He was a historian and a philosopher. So they assigned him the writing of the history of the Los Alamos making of the bomb. But he was the most un-American of all. He used to call it the Un-American Committee. And he was brought up with E.U. Condon and Oppenheimer to the Un-American Committee during McCarthy era. And he was barred from reading his own book.
Wow.
And it's here. If you missed it. You missed the sentence probably because you read everything so quickly today. But anyway, he was barred, and he just, the absurdity. And he said, finally, way after McCarthyism, he was allowed to read it, and he says it here. It was so pedantic. Yeah. It was so boring. He didn't. I was glad that he was not allowed to read it. But the times had changed.
Oh, yeah.
And these people were marvelous. Anyway.
Yeah, of course, in retrospect, this sort of spread some of the intellectual wealth because UMass picked up, actually, a number of faculty from Smith and Mount Holyoke when they started firing people for left-wing connections. So UMass enriched itself. Bard College and Reed College built their reputations by hiring faculty from Ivy League and institutions and very prestigious.
And Ray Ginger. Did you know Ray Ginger? He was an intellectual historian at Brandeis University. He was another one. They took his passport away. He never left the country. Mm-hmm. He was from Tennessee, and he was a victim of that. But this is small compared to the people you picked up from Europe. Mm-hmm. I mean, Nazi victims.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And of course, many of those, Princeton was a kind of magnet for that. And we had many, many literary people from Europe that landed in Princeton at various times.
Well, wasn't he at not with a bang but a whimper? Elliot, he ended up at the advanced study.
Yeah, he was there for a time, and supposedly was the worst person in the world to have lunch with, according to those people I met who did. They said all he wanted to discuss was the fine points. No, actually, it was worse than that, the fine points of Anglican theology. Yeah. And it made for a very long lunch, apparently. Yeah, what is his book? It's
Aging
so famous.
No,
the first one.
Oh.
In that book, he suggested that allopathic medicine suffered intrinsically from this war mentality. It's us against them. It's you.
Oh, no, it's agents of disease.
Yeah, right.
It's all military terminology.
Exactly.
And it has no right whatsoever. And, of course, working all my life in symbiosis, I realized that there's a concept of medical symbiotics. That's the word is Jessica's, but not mine. But anyway, when you have a bacterial human relationship, that's a symbiotic relationship, and we know a whole lot about that, but the language is completely different. For example, the Helicobacterium story, in 2005, this guy Barry Wallace, I think his name was, anyway, he's from Australia, he's the one that swallowed the Helicobacterium and made himself very sick and then cured himself with antibiotics to prove that gastric ulcers had come from infectious bacterium. And the thing that when he gave his talk in Barcelona, I was there recently, he said that he showed the literature. In 1905, people had studied the stomach. They had seen these exact bacteria. They're very distinctive. They're little coils, helical mm-hmm. coils. And they come to large numbers in peptic ulcers. And he said they reported them as the cause of the ulcer. But doctors had said the stomach can't have an acidity, a pH of 1, and therefore those organisms had nothing to do with ulcers. And it took until 2004 or something for this model to be proved without a doubt. And since the guy with whom he worked, the older, more senior investigator with whom he worked, was already sick with ulcers, he didn't want to mm-hmm. swallow that stuff. But this is the kind of experiment of the 19th century to do something like that. And he's been completely... And now these companies that make ulcer, what is it, medication? You know, what do they make?
Pepcid.
Yeah, well, they've now... He's now their darling child. Now they're trying to buy him back. He's great. He's just a very simple microbiologist who believes in data, you know? He's just great.
Yeah, I suppose if I didn't add, it would be for Digel.
Yeah.
I could. No, I'm a sort of the poster boy for what a lifetime of Digel consumption can do for you.
Well, if you have ulcers, I suggest you watch this guy's work.
No, I don't. No. I just like the taste of Digel. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say some of those things. Don't you get a blast of calcium and magnesium or something?
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, all this medicine is just totally irrelevant. That's the point. And it's been totally irrelevant. And he knew this. And now they're curing. Oh, and I think it's going to be the same with with malaria, with certainly with Lyme disease. I mean, the fact is that the people don't know that these insects or worms are vectors. That is, they're carrying very highly co-evolved bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And there, to me, there's no such thing as a new disease. There's new talking. I mean, there's talkie-talkie.
Sure.
There are no new diseases because no new microbiologically born diseases.
Yeah, I mean, the same is true in psychiatry. I mean, you just a new syndrome is proclaimed every year, but it's just something that you can read about in Shakespeare.
No, it's something you could name after the doctor.
That's right.
And they can get tenure.
Nice.
But Lynn, what about when bacteria that you've supposedly evolved? When they say people, you know, take too much antibiotics and the bacteria, you know, capabilities of evolving quickly showed that the antibiotics don't work anymore. Is that new or is that not new?
Well, it's the knowledge about it?
No, the bacterial new
form. The fact that they evolve.
No, the form that they evolve into. Isn't that a new
It's new like, well, let's see. Let me just try to think of some genetic trait that's trivial. It's new like widow's peak versus a straight line on the hair, or it's new like... In other words, yes, you put them in a medium that is loaded with antibiotics, they will overcome them by not taking them in, for example, or by detoxifying them. And you've induced that because otherwise they die.
Right.
So in that sense, it's new. But that means of the 5,000 genes of the bacterium, you've changed a part of one of them. So in that sense, yeah, it's new. The part you change is new. And the fact that that is evolution, even from people who don't believe in evolution, I mean, that's a beautiful example of people's pigheadedness,
yes.
Of which we have many examples in this book.
Well, you see medical... Evolutionary medicine and biology and psychology, I mean, there seems to be an evolutionary, you know, everything that you attach to. But at least medicine, it seems to make a lot of sense to try to understand why, you know, an illness, you know, serves a purpose at some time. And also why someone has survived or why something has survived this far into, you know, where we are in time and hasn't, you know, died off. So I'm just saying that it seems like medicine is, at least part of it, looking at a larger picture.
Well, it should be looking at a larger picture, but in the MIT library, any journal over 8 years is put into humanities or literature. It's not science anymore, so science has become a euphemism for news, and there's no I mean, fine scientists, like I told you before, are humble. They read the literature, you know, and they're too busy to do anything else. In fact, they don't read novels. That was the other thing I was going to say. I don't think, the scientists who I'd love to read this probably won't read it because they don't read that kind of stuff. They read in their field.
There's that one guy's reading History of Science as his airplane, for his airplane reading in the course of his travels, right? There's one, he's got a history of science that he thinks is pop reading for fun.
Well, he's unusual. I mean, my scientists are unusual because they read books. But what was I say? Anyway, the background that you need, all you need to do is read The Health of Nations. Did you ever read that? It's a takeoff the title on The Wealth of Nations. Did you ever read that or hear of that? That was written by an epidemiologist. It's the most fascinating book, and it's despised by almost everybody. Why? He was asking what the most significant medical fact, and this is easily documented, is that the age of at death, the longevity, has increased in every country. I mean, in this Western Hemisphere, even Haiti, which is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, has had a very significant change, and the change was in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And you know that. And you also know that kings were, they tried really hard to keep them alive. They had the best medical attention. So this man has reviewed literature about how kings were treated medically, and it would make your hair stand on end. I mean, how they were bled and poked at and gassed and so on. But do you know what the answer is to the nature of the longevity is?
Mm-hmm. No.
Why? And he has shown without a doubt why. That is, there's a single number that you can measure that will predict longevity. The one number that you can measure, it's not chlorinating the water supply. It's certainly not antibiotics. It's not any of the obvious things that you and I would have guessed, those two being amongst them, right? We would have guessed that that's the reason for longevity. Yeah. It's not increased diet, insofar as increased diet, better diets are correlated with this number. The one number that will predict the longevity of somebody and the number of years in education, how educated they are, which makes it good for us, right?
And
it's fascinating. The probability that someone will die after his mate dies, within a year or two after his mate dies. That's very hard.
But it's not causal, right?
No, it is causal. I mean, this is what his thesis is, that so many people died of hopelessness, helplessness syndrome when their social conditions there was no exit. And when they are educated, they tend to have an exit. And so these other things, their physical exercise, their... And people didn't like this book at all because when he reviewed the medical practices to the kings, now what makes you think that the medical practices have gotten better? They've just got more.
All I know is I've just knocked 10 years off my life by rushing through graduate school. I should have stayed till I was 40 like people do today.
Yeah, well, the number of years in school or in education of some form that makes you learning all the time. It leads to health. Ernst Mayr, the great evolutionist, died at 101. I talked to him like 6 months before.
And he wrote a book, you know.
Oh, he wrote 24 books and two of them after the age of 100.
Right.
But anyway, so I talked to him very shortly before, and I said, well, how are you? It was 100 at that time. He said, well, I'm fine given the circumstances. I said, what circumstances? He said, well, the doctor told me last week that I have metastasized cancer and I don't have too much hope. I said, I feel fine. I said, I'm so sorry to hear that. He said, well, Lynn, I have to die of something.
Yeah. Oh, God.
What a great guy he was.
Well, we've been talking to Lynn Margulis once
too
again.
Too much.
No. We can't talk to you enough, and we will continue this because we had about five other program ideas emerge from our talk today.
Good thing you don't live too far away.
Yeah.
Down the block.
Down the block.
The marvelous Lynn Margulis. If all our scientists had her drive, moral depth, and ability to communicate, maybe, just maybe, we'd find a way out of this mess. Pace requiescat et in amore. Thanks to MR Art Director Pam Glavin for the idea, and to David for the marvelous interview. Our musical theme is from the guitar duel of Vlatko Stefanovski and Miroslav Tadic, and can be found on their Live from Belgrade CD. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.